Welcome to Season 2, Episode 2 of the Scared to Death Podcast. This podcast is organized and presented by undergraduate and graduate students in the Terror Management Lab at James Madison University. My name is Peter Montwell, and I'm the graduate head of the Terror Management Lab. Today, I'm introducing our PR head, Emma Coleman, as she talks to Erica Campbell, the president of the Ernest Becker Foundation and a death doula. And now I'll let Emma take it away.
Okay, Erica. One, it's very nice to meet you. My name is Emma, just so we get that out of the way. We didn't talk much last time. I was too busy scribbling notes. I know you have a doctorate in education. How did you transfer from an educational background to a mental health counselor?
You know, I actually did it in reverse. I started out as a mental health counselor. And I was working in mental health counseling and got a job on a university campus at a nursing home on a university campus. And as a perk for working on a university campus that had a nursing home on it, I was eligible for student education opportunity. So I decided to see if I could get my doctorate paid for. And lo and behold, I did. So I decided to apply for a doctorate of education from that.
Okay. And as I understand, you are involved in the Ernest Becker Foundation. What is Correct. The foundation and what is your official role? So everyone has a little sense of what you do.
Sure. So I am currently, I'm the acting president for the Ernest Becker Foundation. And the Ernest Becker Foundation has been an ongoing concern since our founder, Neil Elgee, established it in the early 70s. Neil Elgee was an endocrinologist based out of Seattle, and he discovered the writings of Ernest Becker when he was practicing endocrinology, and discovered that this was a really wonderful, he read The Denial of Death, and discovered that this was a really accessible way of talking to his patients and his colleagues about the fears of mortality and how humans actually are ramping up for end-of-life conversations, how they kind of think about wrapping up their business or thinking about big life decisions, how they're going to achieve health goals and what they want to do afterwards. So he thought that this was very viable, started talking to everybody about it, and they weren't too impressed with it, but it was such a meaningful thing to him that he decided to start the Ernest Becker Foundation as a pet project. And it really took off in earnest when he retired. So it was his little immortality project that he started as a retirement objective. And with a merry band of other early adopters, this just kind of came became an exciting salon conversation discussion where a lot of people could come together and talk about how people treat each other, why they are motivated to act the way that they do. And it gains a lot of traction. He met people from all over the country and then all over the world. And then I came into it basically in the early 2000s when I met Neil going through my grad program. And I was already ensconced working in end of life work. And Neil was in my doctoral program doing a presentation on death and humor. And that was really just a great dovetail into work that I was already doing on hospice and end of life and compassion care. So he and I hit it off real well. I came out to volunteer for him worked at a lot of conferences that he was having annually at Seattle University, and just got really involved. And that's how I became involved in the Ernest Becker Foundation. Got me to where I am today as the de facto president.
Wow. Very fun. Going back to death and humor.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit about that? Because those don't really mix. you wouldn't think those mix together. I found that a little entertaining. But in this lab, we talk about death in a very humorous way. So it kind of blends in with us, but not really for our listeners. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. So I think that that the death anxiety, the idea of death is such an overwhelming, terrifying idea for sentient beings. We are so terrified of this. That one of the only ways that we really can deal with this and we can get a handle on it is through humor, using comedic effect, black comedy, and sort of taking a pin to it to prick out take some of the air out of the big feelings of it, makes us feel better, makes us relate to it better. So we use humor a lot, and humor has been the biggest tool we can possibly use to deal with the anxiety of that this is going to come around for all of us.
It's gonna happen to everybody at some point.
Indeed.
So I am a communication studies major. So my interest revolves around communication practices between an organization and their publics. Who is the prominent audience of the foundation, and how do you reach them? Is it just limited to elderly populations and the terminally ill, or are these really poorly educated assumptions one might have?
Oh, Emma, that's such a great question, because unfortunately, even though the foundation participants and the members very much skew to older adults and people who have given a lot of thought, tend to be older adults who have they tend to skew older retired adults of a certain demographic, but we're really focusing this on everybody. We have sections on, we think that this applies to everybody who is going to be born and who is going to die. And so this really does apply to young people. It applies to anybody who is grappling with being here and thinking about why it's important to be on this planet, what they're going to do with the time that they're here, and making the most of that, and how they spend that time treating other people, treating the planet, what they want to do to put forth to make the place better or worse or indifferent. So I think that's the big takeaway is, with that, we can use a lot of the things that Becker talks about, which would be, your heroism projects, thinking about, do you want to make the world a better place? Do you want to do something that's going to improve things? Do you want to do things that are, do you just want to amass all the gold, or do you just want to pop out a lot of children? What kinds of things do you want to do do you want to win all of the toys? What's your eventual goal for being here while you're alive on this planet? We really want to help people to define that and maybe think about how they are impacting themselves and other people through bullying or through religious persecution or through family patriarchy decisions, things like that, ramifications, how they impact each other.
Do you ever find that people don't have like an end goal or something they aspire to? Do you find it just kind of, they just want to exist essentially?
Yeah, I think that, I think that that for the most part, we're all driven as meaning-making machines, so that we're all trying to find a purpose. We're all trying to find a meaning. And that's sort of our driving nature, our driving question is to find meaning. And unfortunately, some of us will find a meaning and stick to it and not ever grow out of that one definition or that one thought. So it may be a stunted meaning. That's sort of when we get into these kind of silos where it's like my one definition, my one way is the only way, and I can't see past that. And so I'm not going, my way is being threatened by another worldview. And so I'm going to have to lash out and put down that other worldview. So my worldview is going to win. So that's, I think that's where big conflicts come in.
Interesting. So I want to transition to your focuses currently. So what are you currently working on?
Sure. I'm actually actively a geriatric mental health counselor and a care navigator in my daily practice. I work in a continuing care retirement community in a nonprofit community for about 500 residents in Seattle. Seattle, Washington. And these residents are folks from the age of about 65 up to about 105. So it's a big spread of residents from very independent people who are just looking to, downsize from the responsibilities of their home ownership and all of those things to living in a community, all the way to somebody who is needing health oversight or memory care or needing hospice, and having that kind of community support. So I, as the social worker, for the independent residents, it's a fairly uncommon role that you'll find in communities. For independent residents, you'll find them for assisted living and for skilled nursing, but you won't find them very often for independent residents, because independent residents are de facto expected to be to navigate their own way. But we find that people who are independent don't necessarily have the experience of knowing where to turn for, if they need help, like they have a new health crisis or their insurance needs change, or they have a family issue that comes up. So a family member gets sick or has a mental health issue or something happens and they don't know how to manage it. I get to be a resource for them or turn them on to some other education source or support for something.
Do you find that experiencing such drastic changes, changes their mental health, such as depression and isolation?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think that their support dwindles with the people that are around them and the circumstances that change. So even the seasons of the seasons of the year, certainly COVID changes, but even like with the days of the year changing, as we're moving into the fall right now, the days are getting shorter. So the time that people can actually get outside and be active is different. Being able to go outside and access the sunlight, and feeling that they can actually go outside and walk, is which means going out and doing shopping is limited. And so being able to contact a friend and have a walking date to go to the store is limited. So they feel a lot more constricted and anxious about even doing things that they would naturally want to be doing. Time and energy seems to be compressed and a lot more stressed. Just trying to get through daily activities. It's harder to manage.
Depression and isolation are socially accepted as an inevitable part of growing older. Do you find people are not ready for that isolation?
You know, I don't think that necessarily depression and isolation are accepted as older. I think that's sort of a stereotype that we foist on people that doesn't necessarily have to be there. I think that there are some truths about with COVID for sure that people have been more isolated just by the fact that we have masks and we have these barriers between people coming in and out and things like that. So yes, there are some truths to that, but by and large, I think that we have to really be thinking about breaking through these ideas of isolation. That people really want to be in a community. People want to be communal. People want to be volunteering and finding purpose all the way through the end of their life.
So I am currently in a gender and communications class, and recently we have been focusing on the isolation people face when they're categorized in specific boxes. These boxes range between race, sexuality, gender, and age. Mm-hmm. And the world we navigate is not created for all bodies. What are the most common frustrations you observe from elderly and non-able-bodied individuals? Are their skill sets lost? Are they really frustrated that the world is not designed for their new accommodations? Things like that.
That's a great question, Emma. I think that technology, adapting to technology can be very difficult. That technology may not keep up with the way that older adults learn, so that that if you have technology that has to be updated, and every update means that your interface is going to be completely different, your keystrokes are going to be different, the way that it looks is going to be different. All of this information is going to be different, and you're going to be required to learn something new instead of building on old information. That is a real hardship for people to always be continually learning new interfaces, whether it's a new telephone with new buttons that are in a different placement arrangement than your old button system, or whether it is an upgrade of an Outlook program or something like that, or whether it's trying to navigate Zoom with feedback loops, when you're trying to talk over somebody or something like that, if you're having multiple people speaking at the same time. I think it's really hard for a person who's just congratulated themselves on getting it the first time and then finding out an upgraded program's coming out and they have to learn a new thing just when they've successfully gotten one thing. To have to learn a new technology is just so disheartening.
It's like keeping up with all the COVID rules these days. It's right. Just ever changing.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I think that the other thing is too, that that it's really hard when you don't understand when this why these changes have to come around. Like, it's been working just fine the way it has been. Why did these changes have to come out? So when there's not somebody there, it's very frustrating when something seems to be working just so well, and then all of a sudden it's been taken away from you with just, you know, it's not clearly like the strap broke from something that's really crucial, and you know that it can't work anymore, it's broken, you know, so.
Yeah, I feel like none of us really know how to code technology. So when something comes out, we're like, why do we need that? Why do we need the next new iPhone? But, you know, it comes down to like capitalism, and it comes down to always searching for the better thing or progress, if you will.
I think that even in things like in apartment living, like in a communal living, it's really hard to imagine living in the same neighborhood for like aging in place, because if you notice, like in any fast-growing community, they knock down the old places and put up like townhomes, and a townhome, of course, is by design not created for an old person or anybody basically over the age of 40. You know, if you have bad joints, you know, slogging your groceries up and down stairs, or if you have any kind of depth perception, or if you have, if you're going through chemotherapy or something like that, you can't make these kinds of these adjustments really quickly. So it's a real, you know, it's a real young, healthy demographic that can actually live in these things. And you can't make use of them if you can't access the shower. You can't, you know, you can't make use of parts of the environment that you're in. So so you're forced to relocate to a new place, or you can't use the vehicle anymore because the vehicle doesn't, the vehicle isn't safe to drive anymore. For you, because you can't see out the, you know, you can't see, or you can't whatever the issues are. Yeah.
So the last time we talked, you shared your anecdotal bridge players scenario. Can you explain that again for the audience? Because I found it to be very easy to understand and translate to a wider audience about these struggles that people face.
Absolutely, absolutely. So in my experience with older adults, I do find in communal living that that card playing in particular is a great example of where people show their deficits and where people show their community where they get along and where they don't get along. And a great example of this is bridge playing. So people who play bridge tend to be, in my opinion, the hardest on each other, the most unforgiving community members that I've experienced. And how that seems to be is that bridge playing, because it tends to be a partner game where you are playing with a partner, and there's a lot of high skill around it with numbers and knowing, anticipating what the next moves are going to be. And so when a player who has been proficient all their lives is starting to have gaps and not being able to play proficiently anymore, the other members will start to grumble and may start to, you know, do things to kind of give a vibe like, you know, maybe you're not right to play this anymore.
There's some side eye in there.
There's a little bit of side eye there. So I do have, you know, I have recollection of being working in a community where the very first week that I worked in this community, the head of the bridge club came to me and said, you know, good, you're here. Your job is to get these people out of the bridge club. They are not allowed to play anymore. And I said, no, actually, that's not my job. My job is to help with the community, you know, help you establish community norms so that this is not an issue. But and what I had understood was when somebody was not able to play successfully in a bridge game anymore, the other bridge players would go and create a game in somebody else's apartment and just stop holding it where that person could go anymore. They would just sneak it off and have it someplace else. So they would, they do things to basically ghost somebody and try to get them to not show up anymore. And because they just didn't want to play anymore, instead of just setting up the norms at the beginning, which would be, if you can't play, let's set up a kind of a tiered system where we will have a frank conversation. You know, you can't play at that level that you used to play at. Let's bring you to a level that you can play at, and we'll have volunteers that will buffer that who already have agreed that they can play and they will support you through this. And that's how we worked our ways around it. Now, conversely, the bridge players are really tenacious about kicking people out. I found that poker players and bingo players are really people who love to have people who are with memory deficits in, because then they get to win more money. You know, the more players win, the more chances you have to get a bigger pot at the end of the day, because more people are contributing. So they want more people in, because it increases the size of the pot at the end of the day.
Oh my goodness. Statistically, they want them. Yes. It increases their own chances.
Sure.
That's very funny. So last time we spoke, Isabel, you talked about how you help essentially choreograph the end of someone's life. So what does their last breath look like? How do you choreograph arguably the most natural component of human life? And what does it look like?
Good question. So I am, in addition to being a geriatric mental health counselor, I'm a death doula, certified death doula. And being a death doula, I do, in my community, how that translates is I don't do the actual death doula services with my clients, but I guide them in a general way. So I will set them up with what are the components. Do you want hospice services brought in? Let's talk about hospice or palliative care. When somebody is ready to transition from a cure to a caring position, then we talk about what that looks like. We talk about who is the care network that they have around them. Hopefully that we've already established, but sometimes it's the first time I'm actually meeting the residents, because there's so many residents. Maybe the first time that I've interacted with them and their family. And we'll talk about what their plan is. Are they staying in their apartment? Do they need to go to assisted living to get that support there, because they can't manage it in their apartment? Do they plan to go home with their children? Is that what they're thinking about doing? So what does it look like, and where is it best served for them to be wrapping up the end of their life? And then who are all the people that can help with that? And then we have these wonderful tasks that we can help them kind of guide what friends help with, what skill sets that they have. Are there people who are much more gifted at organizational skills, and more, and some who are more, you know, the magical people who are more about the entertainment, or, you know, the comforts. I'm a really good massage therapist. Well, I'm really good at, you know, setting up the phone tree. I'm really good at, walking the dogs and taking care, you know, making sure that the dog goes to the groomer, and I'm really good at making sure that everybody has a Caring Bridge account and gets all the communications out. Basically helping navigate everybody's role that you want to have, and making sure that everybody's got a role to play, defining what that is, setting up their last, any decisions that they have afterwards as well. So, and then it's basically the practical aspects of what they're going to be going through on a daily basis. If there's pain involved, what does that look like for making sure that they are comfortable? What are the things that they want to have around their comfort kit to keep them in comfort and keep them stress-free, and to also keep all the people that come in there as stress-free as possible too. So having water around, knowing where things are for everybody else, tablets for writing on, notes, notebooks, snacks, things that everyone else could have access to as well.
Mm-hmm. My relatives are actually in an assisted care facility. I am an only child, and on one side of my family, I'm an only grandchild and niece, if that's the correct term. So being inside these facilities is nothing new to me. And I understand the mental stress it's always there in these facilities. So keeping it diminished is it's a hard task. So that's impressive that you help manage stress, especially in family units with so many people. So one time I was speaking to one of the doctors that helps take care of them, and he has a very taboo opinion. He does not always see the need for constant life-saving measures, including surgeries or like open heart surgery or lung draining at 92, 93, 94 years old, because the recovery time is just not there. He sees these measures as a scramble for control when the best care is at home with family. How do you feel about the family unit care practices? Are they helpful? Are they not helpful? Or does it depend between situations, like different family units?
Oh my, yes. I think that that is such a great question, Emma. How do different families deal with their the end of life question is all over the map. I think that there are some families that deal with it in the most open-minded and really beautiful way. They're so curious, and they are so gung-ho about, you know, I'm jumping in with both feet, and I am ready to do this, and I'm doing this as a willing partner with my person, my loved one who is actively dying, you know, and I'm doing this as an act of service, as an act of love, and as an act of curiosity, because I want to do this well. I want to be a good care provider. And then I think there are other people who are terrified, and they really don't want to do this at all, and they're resentful. They're resentful, and they don't like being put in the position of doing any of this. They don't want to be involved in they don't like the reminders of the body failing. Mm-hmm. They don't like to see this person who is declining. And I think that part of it is, you know, that certainly there's the cognitive aspect when somebody is not there as they used to be. There's also, I think there's a certain gratitude aspect. You're not grateful enough for all of the work that I'm doing for you. There's a lot of old resentments from these family dynamics or life dynamics. You know, all of this work that I'm doing is not being appreciated. So there's a lot of tension that can happen with that. And then I think it's just basically fear of, of dignity and loss of dignity that I would never, when people put themselves into somebody else's situation and say, I would never want that for me, that this must be so humiliating for them, instead of just being with it and just being grateful for sharing such an intimate experience.
Do you find that the resentment and just isolating themselves from the situation is built out of fear or their own relationship with the person? Because it seems a little bit fearful the way you were describing it. Like, it's like they don't want to touch it because they don't want to think about it. Like they're pushing it into the back of their brain? Or is it more their relationship was already strained, so they don't want to put in the effort now?
I think it's definitely twofold. Part of it is that we don't do caregiving education for people. Mm-hmm. We don't do any formal caregiving education for caregivers. You really have to seek it out if you're going to. And when you're actually doing caregiving to somebody else, especially a loved one, if you are not consciously thinking about things like temperature or the respect issue, or asking for permission to touch somebody before you intimately touch them, things like this, it is so disempowering to have somebody, even if they, you know, even if it's somebody who you've known all your life, it is incredibly disrespectful to have somebody throw you around like a sack of potatoes, you know, to see you in such a vulnerable state who has you've always been this shown up in one way. And they have, and they've expected you to be in one way, and now you are incredibly vulnerable. So, and particularly if that vulnerability, some people become very humble when they're vulnerable. Some people become extremely angry when they're vulnerable, and they'll lash out, you know, and so they'll make the person who is providing the care that much more like, you know, you're not doing this right. You're hurting me. You're making me angry. And it will cause a very, a really unhealthy dynamic. That's why a lot of people who are doing care for their loved ones, you always hurt the ones you love, right?
Yeah.
oftentimes, you know, a person who you're not related to is a better caregiver. Oftentimes.
Interesting. So transitioning to our last question. This one I'm actually very proud of. I was sitting in my room and I was like, I really like this question. So I wrote it down as soon as possible so I wouldn't forget it. people often say life to death, the human life cycle, is organic and beautiful because we are meant to die. The second you are born, you're dying, essentially. Working in a field designed to help people die at their own accord, do you see beauty in death, or is it a mundane day-to-day activity that you go home and try not to think about for the rest of the evening?
That is a great question. I really like that question. And I do, it does remind me so much of When the first thing that popped up into my head was watching Harold and Maude. When Maude was looking at the field of flowers, or Harold was looking at the field of flowers, and thinking, you know, that all the flowers are the same, and Maude points out, no, they're not. Every single flower is individual. And I think that that's exactly true. I think every single death is particular to the individual, and every experience is very particular, and you can't take that away from anyone, no matter what their experience is. It is so individual to that person. So every time I'm in the presence of somebody who is dying, I am always in awe and in honor of their experience, and trying to be as reverent and deferential to them as possible. So it's quite something to be in there. You know, I never put something on it like, you should be expecting this, or this should be happening now, because it is different every time. Even when people ask me, you know, what should I be expecting? I say, you know, that's a very difficult question, you know. It's so difficult. I think it's just made me slightly better at paying attention to what may be coming up ahead than other people in the room. So that just gives me a little bit of an edge. I think that the nice thing about it is that it does help me to get the families, or the you know, the friends, the loved ones around the room to focus and to focus more on the body as a whole. Not just the face, but everything that could be going on, like what's going on with think about everything. Think about what's going on with the sounds in the entire room, with what's going on with the toes, what's going on with the elbows, what's going on with the dog barking in the backyard, what's going on with, you know, the sound of the humming of the refrigerator in the next room, or so, you know, all of these things that could be helping or causing some kind of an annoyance or discomfort or something like that. So many things that are going on. So, but how that can come in with to the family's mind, so really expand what's going on in that person's sphere.
Wow. Your job is, it's very stressful to me, and not everybody can do it. And I just want to give you like props, because I've spent a lot of time in nursing homes and assisted care facilities, and the people that work there are a different breed. They're different. They have the patience of angels. It's insane. So much care and so much thought into everything they do, and they're so attentive to just sounds, to basically how bodies are in tune to the space around them. And it's phenomenal just to watch them do their job, because I know I could never do it.
Well, you know, I think it's part of that communication. I think it's part of that communication that, you know, it's just like being a communications major. You just learn the signs that are going on, and you just get to be a better communicator. It's just this body is communicating with you something, and you're just picking up the signs. So it's just when you're going to notice things like dry lips, and you're going to notice when somebody is needing to have their face washed with a damp washcloth. You're going to notice when somebody has been lying in the same position for too long and just needs to roll over a little bit. You know, you're going to notice when somebody hasn't had something to drink in a long time and just needs a little bit of, you know, mouth, moistening or something like that. This just comes with, you know, it's all communication.
It is so, everything
and the body tells learned
so far in college is you just have to learn how to communicate with different people, and it can be a hard task because you have to analyze situations, you have to analyze people, but at the end of the day, you can get it done if you just listen and observe. Yeah. That's what it comes down to. So now I want to transition to our rapid fire questions. These are more, I tailored them closer to you and closer to our conversation because it is so like deep, if you will. Sure. But these are just supposed to be like quick answers, nothing crazy. So our first one is, what do you think of Terror Management Lab?
I love it.
I love it too.
I think it's great that you guys can bring in anyone and talk about all of these, like, because, you know, humor and terror and in a lab, I think that's wonderful that you guys can have this opportunity to bring these all these concepts together and then just bring it out onto the podcast too.
Yeah, great. We like to keep our podcast interviews is our podcast our podcast guest, that's the word I'm looking for, they have to have a sense of humor, you know what I mean? Drew Barrymore recently said, I don't trust anybody who hasn't developed humor as a coping mechanism.
Amen.
Okay, so our next one is, what is your favorite part of your job?
I love how much fun stuff my residents have done. My residents teach me so much stuff. Like just yesterday, we had a memory cafe, which I host twice a week. And one of the things we learned was that bananas come in hands, not in bunches. I mean, there are bunches of bananas, but a subset of a banana bunch is a banana hand, believe it or not. Which I did not know about. And my residents did know about that. And so this is the kind of stuff like that we learn, or interesting jobs that I never would have learned anything about. So my residents teach me, and we teach each other stuff all the time. There's so much to learn. So every day is just the most amazing, you know, great curiosity.
Interesting. Next, are you afraid to die?
Not a bit. Not a bit. I've been thinking about it every day. I think about it, and every day I spend some time thinking about it. It's what I meditate on, and then and so I've been processing it. Nope, not at all.
Do you find life exciting?
Very much. Very much.
The way you spoke about your job, I can tell you find life exciting. And what has been your favorite age to live
through? Oh my goodness. I think it's like every patient that I have is that every age I live through is a different age. I couldn't put it on there. I would never want to go back and live another age again, but every age has been very exciting. You know, it's another experience. So I'm excited to have gone through that.
Awesome.
I can't wait for the next age.
And what has been your favorite job so far?
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Oh, well, I would have to say, hands down, being a camp counselor for Easter SEALs camps for disabled kids and adults, was my favorite idea of a job. And if I could turn being a therapist into being a camp counselor, in a retirement community and just turn that into what I did full time. If I could turn every retirement community into a camp, summer camp full time, 24 hours a day, that's what I would do.
That's so fun. Yeah. I feel like that'd be a little bit better than
way better. Yeah.
Than bridge arguments.
Very much.
So what city do you live in? I think we touched on this earlier.
Oh yeah. In Seattle, Washington.
Very rainy.
Yeah. And not this year though. Everything's upside down.
And what's your favorite word to describe your work?
Oh my goodness. It is so experimental. I have so much freedom to do anything that I want to, because it's such, nobody does this job. So I get to make it up as I go along.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah.
So do you like teaching or learning better?
Oh, wow. 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 I love both. I love both. Yeah. I love learning. I love learning from my residents. And then I love turning it around and teaching. I love co-facilitating.
Mm-hmm. What would your last meal on death row be?
Mashed potatoes and broccoli. Giant mound of mashed potatoes and broccoli and a big bottle of Merlot. Yeah.
Oh. If you could go back to your younger life, what would you go back and tell yourself?
I would definitely tell myself that that all the anxiety that I put into growing up, I didn't need to sweat it so much. So I was very anxious as a younger person, and I don't need to be that anxious. Didn't have to worry about what other people thought so much.
Oh, yeah, I'm learning that.
Yeah.
Similarly, right now is an opportunity to give advice to a younger population. What advice would you give to a 20-something-year-old anxious about death?
Oh, boy, that develop your humor skills. Develop your humor because we are all in it, and we are going to, we're all going to die. We're all going to die. Yeah.
It's going to happen to everybody. So might as well have fun with it.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, we can't put off what's going to happen in front of us, because it hasn't happened yet. So, don't sweat what hasn't happened yet. Just be in the moment.
Hmm. And to finish us off, what is your favorite thing about life right now?
Oh my goodness. I love the sunflowers that are like all over. I grew giant sunflowers starting in the pandemic, and they are about, they're about 15 feet, and they're just all around, cascading all around my house now. And so they're making me really, really happy.
Oh, that's amazing. You should email us pictures so we can put it on our Instagram.
I will do that.
Super fun.
I'll do that. They're great. Yeah. Them and Catio Life, which is also my other new thing, because now I have two kittens, pandemic kittens, and Catio, the whole world of Catios opened up to me now that they're not outdoor cats.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Yeah. That's been, the world of Catios is like my new favorite weird thing, that like seeing what people do with exotic Catios is just a crazy thing. It's the craziest hobby.
That's so fun. Oh my gosh. I made one last year for my cat, and
they're so cool.
I was balling on a budget, but we still made it work.
Amazing.
Okay. So thank you for talking to us. It was phenomenal. I love talking to you. I could talk forever. I'm sure I could come up with a million more questions to ask you, but
we're cool.
It was phenomenal.
Hi again, it's Peter. Thank you again, Erica, for joining Emma on the podcast. To the listener, thank you for joining us today on the Scared to Death podcast with Emma and Erica Campbell. This podcast has been produced and presented by undergraduate and graduate students in the Terra Management Lab at James Madison University. And we will see you next time.